These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
We're discussing cultural education and place-based education today on the program. So what does that mean exactly? How does it look in the classroom? And why might it matter in a modern world? That's our discussion this hour. Plus, we hear one strong voice in favor of school choice and his explanation for why culture and school shouldn't mix, and a report on the ways some rural classrooms are integrating Alaska Native languages, traditions, and ways of being across the state. That and more on Kids These Days today. Hi, I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today's show is going to be one with a variety of opinions and information about cultural education reform and so-called place-based education. If you want to add your voice to the conversation, please send a message to mail@kidsthesedays.org or write directly on our website or post your comments to our Facebook page. With me in the KSKA studio today are Linda Prince and Paul Ongakuk. Linda Leal Prince grew up in Grayling and graduated from Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka. She earned her bachelor's degree from St. Olaf College in Minnesota, where she studied sociology, anthropology, and Asian studies. She also has a master's degree in education from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Linda taught English as a second language in Japan and Germany for 6 years, and currently teaches world history and Alaska studies at Bartlett High School in Anchorage. Thanks for being with us on the program today, Linda.
I'm glad to be here.
And Paul Ongakuk is Inupiaq and a graduate of Nome Belts High School and the University of Washington. He holds degrees in history, religion, philosophy, and education. He's a professor at the College of Education at the University of Alaska Anchorage and was recently a visiting professor of Native Studies at Dartmouth College. Paul previously joined this program during the holiday season to talk about the value of giving and teaching generosity to our children. Thanks for being here and welcome back to Kids These Days, Paul.
I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
Well, as I mentioned, today's topic is cultural education and place-based education. Maybe the best place to start the discussion is to talk about what those things are in terms of definitions. What is cultural education and how is it related to or maybe different from this idea of place-based education? Start with you, Linda.
As I've been pondering this question, as I was preparing for today, it's a huge question. And so for me, cultural education in the context that I currently work in at Bartlett, where we have such a diverse student body, to me that means that the students can see themselves in the curriculum in my classroom and that what I'm teaching speaks to them from all these different cultures that they come from and that we discuss all their different cultures or that they don't feel alienated, that they don't feel like their culture is not addressed at all, which is sometimes difficult if you're like studying Rome, but that's to me cultural education in one sense. At the same time, in my Alaska Studies class, a large segment of the first quarter the first part of the semester, we talk about Alaska Native culture because that's a huge part of Alaska Studies, is its Native people. So that's one form of cultural education that I do. And cultural education back in Grayling, where I grew up, that had to do with learning our traditional culture and hearing the stories, learning the language from the elders that were invited into the school. And to me, that was also cultural education.
So it sounds like it, you know, you just described a few different examples there of how we could define cultural education. There's the cultural education of inclusiveness, where you have a classroom of high school students, all of whom come from different backgrounds, and you want each of them to feel like they're represented in what you're teaching, and where they come from is honored in what you're teaching. And then, as you say, there's also this idea of the place-based part of it, where, the location that we are. Right now, we are in a studio in Anchorage, but of course, there's communities all across Alaska. And while there's some similarities in culture in all of those communities, there's also individual things about the culture in all of those communities. And you bring that up when you talk about growing up in Grayling. Paul Ongogook, how about you? What do you think? Is there an overarching definition of cultural education, or is it, you know, in very many pieces and represented in different ways, like Linda suggests?
Cultural education is an integral part of the history of public education in America. There hasn't been a time where education's been separated from culture. It's just that for many people, the culture that was used, and in some places still continues to be used as the framework for education, is the one that they're familiar with, and so they don't think of it as culturally based education. It's all culturally based.
So maybe explain that point a little bit. So you say it's cultural education has always been a part of public education, but maybe right. people haven't seen it as such?
Can right. It's like fish understanding water, I suppose. Bernard Balin, who was at one time the president of the American Historical Association, wrote just this wonderful little essay. It was actually originally a paper that he delivered called Education and the Forming of American Society. It's just a little gem. And in that, he just lays out the enormous range of questions about the formation of education and the culture in the development of America as a society. And he goes back, well back to, among other things, the Old Deluder Satan Act, which was...
I'm not familiar with that.
Yes, it's Satan as the deluder of souls. And the way to counter that in Massachusetts among the Puritans and the Pilgrims was that you had to be able to read the Bible. And the problem was that there was so much land available and a shortage of laborers that many families were putting their kids to work to help make the family farm more profitable. And at the expense of teaching them to read and write, particularly reading, which was really essential for the kind of salvation and participation in the godly community, as Massachusetts understood there being a light on the hill, sort of. And so they saw that families were failing in that, and so they required families to support a teacher to teach reading and writing, particularly reading the Bible as a fundamental. And so we get the seed of American education, compulsory public education.
What's the response to that, you're saying?
And yes, and it's culturally based. It's immersed in the idea of learning to read not just the Bible, but a certain version of the Bible, and learning to read it devotionally rather than critically. So there's, from the outset, we've been off to the races. Horace Mann defined the purpose of public education as not only teaching us skills, but teaching us a view and an excitement and a loyalty as American citizens. Thomas Jefferson earlier arguing that education was essential for a kind of democracy, an experiment in representative government, means that we as citizens have to be educated in a way to support and participate in a representative government. So we've been doing this culturally nested public education from the outset, and we continue to do it today. It's impossible to think of public education without it.
So let's think about Alaska specifically here now. So, you know, I think I certainly have heard it said on many occasions that that there is a conflict, and maybe you guys can tell me your opinion on whether or not there's a conflict between what is perceived by many as a Western-based education system of our public in terms of Western culture thinking education system, our public education system, and the traditional ways of Alaska Native peoples, and that there's conflict between that system and the way communities say, our smaller rural communities function. Would you say that, that is an accurate statement? And if not, why not? And if so, why is that happening in Alaska? Maybe we can understand a little bit better. Linda.
I think that the education system that we have now is certainly massively different from the education or the way that youth were educated prior to Russian contact, for example, and the way that, I guess, the elders used to a long time ago, or even families would disseminate or educate a person, was in the home or a community hall or the kajim.
And what's the kajim?
The community gathering place, or where, yeah, well, community gathering place, basically. And versus being, you know, where it was community learning. It wasn't just, you know, the young people. It was where knowledge was shared. And the knowledge holders were a lot of times the elder people who had experienced all these things and were teaching the younger people. And now in the way we have education now, these schools, like here in Anchorage, here at Bartlett, well, although we try to really encourage parent involvement and community involvement, it really depends on the sometimes area of town that you live in or how involved parents will be. And so it can actually be quite separate from what's going on in the homes and what's going on with family. Although, like I said, I think, you know, we try hard to include those families or parents in education. It's kind of up to them also.
Excellent. Paul Ongaguk, you've been also a classroom teacher. Right now you're a college professor and in the classroom, but then haven't you also taught in public schools?
Yes, I taught in Kotzebue for 6 years, elementary, middle, and high school. And I also taught while I was at Illisavik College in Barrow. I was teaching at the university level, but in many ways working with entry-level students. Mm-hmm. And I continue to teach periodically with, you know, classrooms, high school age students whenever I get the opportunity.
So what do you say about the idea that there's just inherent conflict in between the way the public school system is set up and traditional ways of learning?
Well, I think traditional ways of learning is complicated. It included in our system, an Inupiat, typically a nephew would have an uncle, a niece would have an aunt, sort of writ large. We kind of cheat on the term. So cousins of your same age group, dad, are counted as uncles. Mm-hmm. So, and so they select, you know, by disposition. And elders are there to sort of make sure you stay on the rails and community involvement. And it's a whole variety of things. It's teaching you about disposition and attitude and learning, at the end of the day, how to be a contributing member of the community. That's really what it's all about. Whereas in the school system, the modern sort of American school system, it often centers more on individual success and individual attainment. After all, when you sit there, you're doing exams under No Child Left Behind, and the grades are your own. You know, they're so it's a very different model. It works well for the kind of individualism that our public schools are working on. And we also try to, in public schools, we pay attention to the idea of developing civic mindedness and community education. It's always, I think of it as almost the JV squad in how schools are often driven, particularly with, you know, this federal mandate about testing. It's really put some pressure on that.
So wait, you say the civic and community mindedness part of public schools is put in a diminished position to some of these other things that people are trying to teach so that kids do well on tests? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Huh. Well, this is Kids These Days today, and I'm Shannon Sheehy, and I'm in the studio with Paul Ongaguk and Linda Prince. Today, we're talking about cultural education and place-based education. Recently, the Alaska Policy Forum brought education reformer and school choice advocate Dr. Ben Chavis to Alaska. Dr. Chavis is best known for his work in California. He took a poor-performing Oakland Middle School and totally turned it around. That school, the American Indian Public Charter School, is now one of the highest-performing schools in the country, despite having multiple factors that many believe can hinder overall student performance. The student population there is made up almost entirely of minorities, English language learners, and the economically disadvantaged. So, as their principal, how did he do it? We're about to ask him that, but first, a little background about Dr. Chavis. Ben Chavis was born into a Lumbee Indian family of sharecroppers and attended segregated public schools in Robeson County, North Carolina. He went to college in Arizona on an athletic scholarship. He's held many jobs in his life and is now chief executive for American Indian Model Schools, the organization formed to recreate the success of that Oakland Middle School elsewhere. Dr. Chavis spoke with me while he was in Anchorage.
I started out with the school choice movement, and in 2000, there was this school in Oakland, California, American Indian Public Charter School, that they were going to close. It was the worst school in the state, and that's how I got involved. And what I saw when they had this school, they were what I call playing Indian. They said, we're going to teach culture, we're going to teach all, you know, culture is such a vague term. It's like you can say I'm religious, and you could be 10,000 different religions. Culture is the same way. That's where I see that term. It's one of the vaguest terms there is. But they really weren't teaching anything. They were teaching children to be victims. They taught them how to come to school late. You know, you come to school at 9 instead of 8 because Indians supposedly can't get up early, which I think is very racist myself, and ignorance more than racist. That's just ignorance. It's not really racist. So I came in and I said, you know, we need to change this thinking. These kids can do anything than any other ethnic group can do. And we had, you know, we had about 28 kids that first year.
28 kids in the whole, and this is a middle school.
Yes, it's more of an alternative school. There were black kids and Mexican kids and Chinese kids and a couple of Tongan kids. But so we, by the end of the year, we had 60 kids. We started school at 8:30. Kids came to school on time. If you were late, we'd give you, if you're 1 second late, you got an hour detention after school.
Really?
Oh, yes.
And this, I imagine, is completely different from how it was run before.
Oh, yes. So, and there was a lot of resistance from the kids and the parents in the beginning. And then by the end of the year, people started to adapt. And I taught them how to, you know, we worked on a reading, we worked on the writing, we worked on the math. And the first year, we were the most improved school in the whole city. Our test scores shot up. And then parents started to buy into it. They could see their children were changing. Mm-hmm. And once you get buy-in, once people can see a result that, you know, being on time is important, working hard is important, practicing math, practicing reading, practicing science, practicing good human behavior, respect. Excuse me. When they saw that, they started to support the model.
So tell me more. I want to know more specifically about the model. So you talked about, for example, that if you're even a minute late, that results in an hour-long detention. So what were some of those real obvious disciplinary-type changes that happened, and some of the other things, too, within the classroom?
No excuses, you know. You come to work, and you come to school, and, you know, I notice in America we have a lot of excuses. It's not just the kids, it's the adults. You know, you'll talk with kids. Well, you know, Dr. Chavis, I didn't want to call you because I didn't want to bother you. That really is an excuse. People would throw the monkey back on you. Oh, I didn't want to upset you, so I didn't bother you. All those are excuses. I'm not interested in any excuses. Bother me. Do what you're supposed to do. Don't come up with an excuse because I get really irritated. But American Indian model is based on family, strong family emphasis, what you and I were discussing earlier. It's not just mom and dad. It's mom, dad, grandma, teacher, janitor, secretary. Everybody's here to watch out for you. Everybody's here to discipline you. Everybody here is to educate you. Everybody's here to make sure you're successful. And we're going to work with that extended family who's interested in your success. And we're going to stay away from the people who aren't really interested in your success.
You were the principal there for how many years were you principal
there?
7 years. And there were some really just amazing changes that happened from that first year into that seventh year with your students. Isn't that right? Can you tell me about some of the successes?
Oh, yes. You know, we had such, these kids are from the ghettos in Oakland. And my philosophy is those are the easy kids to work with. It's the opposite of what we say in public education. Those kids have nothing. You know, when they go home in the afternoon, they go home to total poverty. So we would keep them at school late and work with them. We would teach them math. And then after they became very good, let's say you're a sixth grader, and by the time you're in eighth grade, you excel at mathematics, we would pay you $12 an hour to teach the sixth graders. So you see how we created an economic incentive for the kids to improve? That's what you can do when a family has a choice to send their child in any school system. That school can be creative with their financing.
This is in the charter school model, right?
Our philosophy was we want to put money back in our children's hands and in their parents' hands, but we're going to reward them for being smart. So once we started paying these kids as tutors, then the kids were seeing, you know what, if I do well in math, I can become a tutor and I'll get paid more than my mom who was working at McDonald's. In high school, we'd pay them $15 an hour. When you get to college, we pay you $20 an hour. So it's a gradual increase. But these kids started seeing the value of education and how it could pay off. They didn't, you know, we tell kids in Anchorage and other parts of the world, well, you get an education, it's going to take care of you later. But we're talking 10, 12 years later. Our kids see it instantly.
It's an interesting difference for sure, because one is really concrete and right there, and it's an opportunity for now versus sort of an abstract concept like
12 years
when
down
you
the
have
road.
That college diploma in your hand, then you'll be able to make money with your education. It's really interesting.
So our kids, they're sixth graders, and this eighth grader is tutoring them, and they're like, an eighth grader says, well, I used to be low also, and I'm getting paid $12 an hour to tutor you. And so, you know, if you improve, and then the kids would come, Dr. Chavis, so if I improve and I do, I'm gonna get one of those jobs? Yes. And it became an incentive for the kids. You have an incentive. The more listeners you get, you know, it contributes economically to your organization. You guys don't get, can you imagine the least listeners you got, the worst job you did, the more money you got? There would be no incentive.
If no one was listening, then we would be canceled.
Right. Well, in the public schools, if we don't educate kids, we still get the money. We get more money. It's a you weren't aware of that?
I was aware of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I have to tell you, it was when I was reading about you and watching some of the online resources that are provided by you and some of your organizations that I heard that framed in that way. And that was a first for me, because I've heard it from the opposite direction, like, oh, you need more assistance to perform this function, to educate the kids. Therefore, you know, in this situation where you're failing, you get more resources, which is a different lens through which to look at it.
Oh, yeah. I'm the worst thing that could happen to public education. They hate me. They accuse me of everything.
Yes, I did. I want to bring that up, actually, because I did see that you have been accused of using some techniques in the classroom and with students that are controversial. In particular,
really?
Yes.
Like
name-calling and embarrassing kids so forth in class. So I want you to address those criticisms that I'm sure you know.
Oh, name-calling. If you act like a fool, I'll treat you like a fool. If you act like a winner, I'll treat you like a winner. Isn't that what coaches do? Are they controversial? You know,
sometimes.
Yeah. If you win, let me tell you something.
Right. That's true. If they're not winning.
I'm controversial because I tell the truth. You're Mexican and you come to work, you come to school late and you're low performing. People aren't going to see you as a lazy Mexican. That's controversial. That's the truth. People do judge you by your race. Let's be honest here. Your show's broken down into different ethnic groups. You got the native populations. So that's based on race, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We are judged by race. But in liberal America, where, you can't say that. You can't say that, that call them a lazy Indian if they do bad. But that's what the public really says. Most people aren't as honest as I am. And I'm telling them what the public's going to say about them.
So you don't think that calling a kid who's of Mexican descent who comes in late and saying, hey, you're going to be thought of as a lazy Mexican if you do that, you don't think that that is in some way damaging to that child?
The truth is damaging. Now, listen to what you said. So if I tell him the truth, how he's going to be perceived by the public, I'm damaging him. What about when he gets out in the real world and he can't get a job? That's damaging.
That's Dr. Ben Chavis speaking with me, Shanna Sheehy, recently in our Anchorage studio. This is Kids These Days. It's a weekly conversation about issues that are important to Alaska families and our whole communities. And today I'm speaking with Linda Prince and Paul Ongoguk, and we're talking about cultural education. And in the time we have left for this half of the show, I'd like you each to respond to Ben Chavis. There's a lot in there, and we don't have a whole lot of time to respond, but I want to give you each a chance. So let's see, Linda, maybe I can start with you.
I think what Dr. Chavis is talking about in terms of when he says you shouldn't be teaching these culture classes, that was really taking a step back or at least not helping students to step forward. I mean, I agree with that in a sense that, yeah, if you're just teaching like basket weaving, for example, and say, oh, now you're a graduate, now go do something with that. I don't think that's preparing these students for life in this country. And in terms of the tough love, I mean, that's not my style. I know that some people certainly have that. But, you know, I think there is a distinction between saying, hey, you're a lazy Mexican, or what you're doing right now can be perceived as being a lazy Mexican behavior, you know, and rather than saying that this is what you are, this is. But I think there are so many different styles of teaching, and I'm all about diversity in terms of in any, I don't know, scenario, I guess. I know my way is not the only way to do it, and that's the way he would do it. I personally wouldn't do it that way. And I think my approach is to have people feel a little more welcomed in my classroom. But I do believe in high standards. I also believe that you should have an expectation about students showing up on time and being prepared. I don't think that has to do with, I mean, and you can have that in any school. That can be anywhere. Back out in a village or here at Bartlett or anywhere. So
do you think it's true? You work in a public school.
Yes.
Do you think it's true that there are, for lack of a better term, is there laxness about things like being on time and tardiness and some of these high expectations that he's saying are so important?
Depends on the classroom. It depends on the teacher. It depends on the culture in that school that they're trying to establish. I know that when at Bartlett, when we've been working on a freshman academy for the last few years, and we've been trying to set up those high standards where we're not accepting late work. There's no excuses. That kind of, I guess you could say, I don't know about tough love, but because that's the expectation when these students are going to go on in the later grades after their freshman into college and into the workforce, to be honest. I mean, if you have something that's due at a certain time, in the real world, there are deadlines. Mm-hmm. And so students do need to know how to meet those and how to be successful once they graduate from school. Because, mm-hmm. Of course, not every kid's going to go on to college or be professionals or whatever. I mean, there's some who are, you know, they have to clock in and are expected to be there. Otherwise, you'll lose your job. So I think those are real practical expectations or real expectations. So I don't think he's too far off in that. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, maybe his style of going about it might be a little different. But and in these schools, you can see, I mean, but even in different classrooms, there are different cultures in these classrooms, right?
Yeah.
I mean, really,
right,
honestly, right. Culture is just, it's like Paul said.
Sometimes
I mean, it's
call
like
it school
a
climate,
yeah,
or classroom climate, right? But it's kind of the same idea.
Right. And I think you and probably listeners out there can remember the teachers' classrooms that they went into. And there was definitely in some where it was not such a bad thing to turn in a late assignment. It was okay. You know, you still got full credit. And others were like, what held you to a different standard?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's foreign to anybody unless you went to a really small school and they all agreed on exactly what they were going to do.
Paul Ongoguk, how about you? Any reaction to Ben there, Mr. Chavis, Dr. Chavis?
Well, I think one of the things that it reminded me of is that even in the military, the name calling has just gone away. It's sort of the unacceptable behavior among drill instructors going through basic. And some people look back and say, oh, it was the good old days when, you know, a DI could get in your face and bark at you and say things about you, your family, your community, culture, language, whatever. But they've moved away from that for the simple reason that it's just not as effective as a form of instruction. he's gotten remarkable success, and I look at it and I think, well, it's because you're highly motivated, focused, and kids and families will see that you're investing in those kids, their future, and the families start supporting that. They might take the bullying, the verbal bullying, in spite of your success. In spite of they're taking that
because along with the whole package kind of thing.
The package, rather than as something that really is educationally smart or even as effective as you would hope.
Well, like I mentioned, you're tuned to Kids These Days on your local community radio station. You can share our show with Alaskans in any community. Tell your friends and family to find us online at kidsthesedays.org. Kids These Days is a production of the Content Producers Guild, an independent media organization. We're distributed through a partnership with the Alaska Public Radio Network, and we record this program at the studios of KSKA FM in Anchorage. I'm Shanna Sheehy, host of Kids These Days. We're taking a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about more cultural education methods and reform with my guests, Paul Onkagook and Linda Prince. Stay with us. With a growing emphasis on testing to gauge whether or not our students are learning enough by the time they graduate, it's a fitting time to be talking about what it takes to be ready for college. That's the subject next time on Kids These Days. We'll find out about various Alaska programs that prep kids before they begin their freshman year at university, learn about some individualized mentorship opportunities, and get the scoop on the U of A's push to get students through school faster. Join us for that and more next time on Kids These Days. We're back. You're listening to Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today's conversation is about cultural education, a kind of place-based education that takes place in our state. I'm talking with Linda Prince and Paul Onkagook today. And before we hear more from them, we're going to continue my recent interview with former American Indian Public Charter School principal and school choice advocate Ben Chavis. In the first half of the hour, he talked about how he transformed one failing California school into a high-performing one, in part by enforcing strict attendance and behavior rules, offering cash incentives for good academic performance, and raising overall expectations for kids from all walks of life. He also says success came from focusing on the basics, reading, writing, and math. Now we hear Dr. Chavis's views on whether or not it's the place of the public school system to be teaching culture. Here's the continuation of that interview.
There's an old proverb. It says you can teach a man a fish and he'll eat for a lifetime. You give him a fish and he'll eat for a day. Well, in the public schools, we're doing a very good job of teaching these native kids and a lot of white kids to only eat for a day. We're teaching them to become dependent on us. And that's sad. And we're doing it for the money. What are the other reasons? Why would we not be teaching these kids? Why would we focus on nonsense? Culture? We're going to teach self-esteem? I don't know any university in America you can get into if you put on your resume, I have good self-esteem. I took 3 self-esteem courses. I don't know where you can get a job saying that.
Now, going back to that and back to the description of the reality of our geography in Alaska and these remote villages where education is happening, in some districts, for example, the Bering Strait School District, which comprises schools like Unalakleet and other that are along the Bering Strait, they've adopted a standards-based model. This is like part of the Reinventing Schools Coalition model. And it incorporates a lot of cultural activities and so forth into that education model. Well, I wanted you to comment on that, but I also am looking to you, since you are so thoughtful about education reform, in our circumstances in Alaska and rural Alaska, what do you see as possible solutions outside of what you've already described?
I think, first of all, that model undermines the family.
The standards-based model?
No. The culture model.
Okay.
The culture model undermines the family. You take the responsibility from the family, grandma, grandpa, aunts and uncles, and you say the school's going to do it. That's not the school's job. The taxpayer has no interest in funding a program that's going to be teaching culture. That's really, native culture, that's really the family, and you preempt the family. As a matter of fact, that's the worst thing you could do to tribal society is when you take away responsibility from them. Why don't the public school instead say, you know what? We're going to teach reading, writing, math, and this is what's going to cost us. And then we're going to create a community culture czars, because you guys know the culture better than we do. And what we're going to do is we're going to help subsidize what you guys are doing. But that's your job. Our job is to teach reading, writing, math, science. You're natives. You know your culture. You teach them that. Shouldn't the natives be teaching the culture at home? Tell me this. Do we have Chinese culture courses in Alaska public schools? Do we have Jewish culture courses in Alaska public schools? You think the Jews or the Chinese would ever be so stupid to trust the public schools to teach their culture? No, the Jews and the Chinese teach their culture themselves. If you're Chinese, you offer what's called Saturday classes, and you can go study Mandarin, and you can study how to write Chinese. You can study Chinese art. It happens all over the United States. I've been to the schools. I promise you, they have it here in Anchorage. Chinese aren't stupid. They would never, ever be so naive as to trust the public school. I'm amazed at any Indian group. Indian people, we're a little backward. If we trust the public school, this is the same school system that would not allow us to go to school with whites. And we're trusting them now. Ooh.
In our state, in many instances, there was, an absolute ban on speaking indigenous language and that sort of thing.
Not only a ban on speaking and on attending. They didn't want us in their school. That's where it was. I couldn't go to a white school, so I'm going to trust public education. It was the public school that would not let the blacks go. In North Carolina, we didn't have public high schools. I was reading, didn't have public high school until 1919 for blacks. My people, look up the University of North Carolina at Pembroke. It started as an all-Indian school because these rednecks would not allow my ancestors to go to public school. Today, it's a university. Their racism did us a favor. We entrenched, and we said, we're going to teach our kids. My tribe never said, when you look at my tribe, we didn't say we were going to teach culture in 1887. We said we're going to teach math, reading, writing, and science, and we're going to whip these white people. That's what we did. That's why my tribe's still here. So these tribes who trust the public schools, they have some real issues. But since 1970, Indians have gone backwards, my tribe included, because the idiots in my tribe, now they say you should teach culture. But that's not what my great-great-great-great-great-uncle said. Anderson Locklear, in 1907, he met with President Theodore Roosevelt. And he talked to Theodore Roosevelt about how they're teaching math, how they're teaching writing. He didn't say we're teaching Indian culture in 1907. He'd have been laughed out of our tribe. You think in 1907, my ancestors were so stupid they would trust the public school to teach culture? So, yeah. I mean, there's no logic in what these people are doing. I mean, analyze it. Does it really make sense? I ask you, Shannon, does it make sense what I'm saying? My questioning of it, when you study history of public education in Native people, is there any logic to what we're doing today?
Well, I think what's so interesting is that it's such a huge question. What can be done to make it better? I think that you provide some really interesting ways to have that discussion.
Simple. No money. My ideas don't cost any money. It's so simple to do. People don't want to do it because they'll lose money. Let's be honest. To lose money. Because a lot of these tribes in these remote areas, like where I grew up, what they do is now they can put their sister-in-law on the payroll. And she's the culture expert. That's what it's all about, my friends. It's about the money. Let's get them on the payroll. But if you had a system of school choice, what would happen? And you say, we're going to fund schools that are successful. In reality, the politicians are saying we need all this native culture and stuff. But you know what these parents want for their kids? They want them to be able to do some math, reading, and writing.
Dr. Ben Chavis is the chief executive for the American Indian Model Schools Organization. You can find out more about him and his work from our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. I'm Shannon Sheehy, and today Paul Ongogook and Linda Prince are both with me in the studio. I'd like to get right at responses. We are eager to hear some comments you both might have about many of the things. Dr. Chavis says a lot in that piece, and I'd really like to hear what you have to say.
Well, I don't think that Dr. Chavis really knows the situation in rural Alaska. I think he claims to, on some say, I think I'd heard him say at a different time how, I grew up in a place where there was no grocery store and things like that. It's quite a different thing to grow up in a place where there's not a road system mm-hmm. and there's not access to those things, and you see a road out of a village. So I'm not really sure he fully understands the context of what goes on here in Alaska. Alaska's always very different, I think, from other parts of the United States, and certainly when it comes to education in the villages. He says a number of things that touches kind of a nerve, and especially when he says, like, how can, you know, people be so stupid as to teach culture and that they're idiots if they think that they can do that or can trust a public school system to do that. Well, I mean, out in the villages, there's not a whole lot of choice, is there, when it comes to education. I mean, there's one school. I guess there now is a bit of a movement to regional schools. And when I was growing up, I could go to Mount Edgecombe. Mount Edgecombe is still there, and that was one choice. But the schools are the center of the community a lot of times. Basketball games are going there all the time. I mean, this is where you have gym nights. People gather at the school. And it is a place of power as well, because a lot of employment, there aren't a lot of employment opportunities, and there are a lot of jobs at this school. And so the people who work at the school, I mean, they're really in a position of power, aren't they? I mean, I feel that even here, as I sometimes see some of my students more than their parents see them in a week. And to involve the community members in the school and teach the culture, I think, is crucial. And I think then you have buy-in, because why go to those schools if they don't teach anything about your own history or acknowledge the value in what you know or your family knows or your community knows?
Like going back to what you said at the very beginning, that you look at the students in your class and you try to make sure that each of them feels included in who they are and where they come from. And you're saying that that adds to that buy-in, like they feel represented.
Absolutely.
They feel
understood. The students, for success, I really think they need to see themselves in the classroom, in the curriculum, that it makes sense for them, that it speaks to them, that they feel valued. And then you can achieve so many more things when they love being there and want to be there and feel like they matter, that they really do, that they're a fabric of this whole country, rather than, because certainly there is a culture being taught, and if you're not careful or make an effort to include many cultures, it is the dominant white culture or Western culture for sure. And so I can't say that I agree with Dr. Chavis on a lot of the things that he's on some things, certainly talking about high standards and expectations. And when he says, you know, like, well, schools, you know, back in 1907, if the tribe back then, if they had been teaching Native culture, well, at that time, and we had that here in Alaska, where certainly during the time of, like, when you talk about land claims or even before that, and when Native people were trying to catch up, in a sense, in terms of being successful in society, they had to learn to walk in two worlds, and they had the traditions down. It's the non-traditional Native society that they had to become more educated in, and that's why they said that they were teaching them reading, writing, and math. I mean, they should be literate at any time, for sure, and back then that was what the focus needed to be. And now that there's, especially with the testing and everything, now there is that emphasis on reading, writing, and math, but what about that other part? And that society has moved on so quickly, and Native people or people in rural areas and with the modernization, with the access of television, with all the media, it's become really important to be walking in those two worlds again. But that means preserving and recognizing and remembering those traditions and keeping those alive, mm-hmm. because I think that's really important to the self-esteem of the person and to that diversity that I mentioned earlier, that we, you know, should we all look the same and have studied only the same things and walk and talk about the same things? No. You know, why not strengthen any conversation with a diversity of ideas and backgrounds and
perspective,
yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Paul Ongaguk, how about you?
Well, I'm not going to call him an idiot, which would be one distinction between us, I suppose. And it's a part of what tells me that he may not have caught the idea of what it means to teach our students and model for students and young people the idea that someone can disagree with us and we can do it in a respectful manner. So failing that, let's move on to the next one. His analogies of the Chinese and Jewish people having Saturday schools and that's a way to teach Native education or Native culture in villages. And of course, the difference is that how would you want people in Israel to learn a language? What language are they supposed to learn? Well, in Israel, I suppose, for most people, the idea would be logical that it would be Hebrew, right? And in China, what would be the language that people would use? Well, I think it would be Chinese, right, as the dominant language. And I suppose that's a part of the distinction. Everyone has this story, and it's odd that he's lumpy and he's missing the point that if the Yupik don't learn, teach, and have a place to speak Yupik here in Alaska, there is no other place. This is the homeland, right? And Alaska Native languages were here before the Egyptians knew what pyramids were. And one of the arguments that we might understand for Alaskan education is that that's a benefit, that's not a cost. One of the ongoing great attractions for Alaska, for many people, is not only wildlife, not only the scenery, but it's the Alaska Native cultures. Well, why do we treat Alaska Native cultures as though they're a wonderful benefit for tourists, and somehow magically we want them to continue, and then we would follow this doctor's idea of marginalizing or eliminating or not supporting these languages and cultures as a part of a unique Alaskan education? What makes Alaskan education Alaskan rather than just Minnesota, Texas, or California education in a better landscape, right? And I think that's one of the questions that we as Alaskans should engage in and should consider as a part of the value of what we can do. It's just remarkable to me that it's an argument we have to make in 2012, but here we are.
Well, thank you both for your responses to Dr. Chavis. I thought it was important to have multiple perspectives on this program, especially about this issue, which is, as you say, Paul Ongaguk, very near and dear to what it is that we are as Alaskans and as educators and people who send our kids to school. This is Kids These Days, and Paul Ongaguk and Linda Prince are with me today in the studio. In Ben Chavis's opinion, tribes are crazy to let public schools take over the teaching of culture, but in plenty of Alaska school districts, there is a concerted effort to integrate the cultural and academic curriculum. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran learned about two such efforts, one private and one public.
At Nikechut Iliksagaviak, children ages 3 to 7 are immersed in Inupiaq culture, from the language to the seasonal cycle of activities to the values and spirituality. Agnik Schaefer and her husband Pete Schaefer helped start the private nonprofit school a dazen years ago when young parents in Kotzebue were asking for a way to teach their kids Inupiaq. Agnik says the whole curriculum is based on the community.
People from the community, from the region, gather together to talk about one subject, like maybe fishing. There's different types of fishing and we record them. Men would get together and talk about hunting, what type of hunting. It's all recorded. And then there's a few of us that got together and started putting it down in the curriculum. And our curriculum is also Alaska-based. The standards are also in there.
So the children spend time out on the tundra and out on the ice, doing whatever the community is doing. Back in the classroom, people bring in ptarmigan or rabbits, and the children learn what to do with them. Agnek says one of the most important things they learn is respect.
When we have a difficult child, when they first come in, our students are always like that. When they first come in, they just don't know what respect is, and some don't know how to get along with other students. So we would have them look at each other in the eye and say, who do you see in the pupil of that eye? And they'd look and they say, me, okay. When you're hurting that person there, you're also hurting yourself because you're in that person and that person is in you. The child is slowly turning around and become a respectful person in that way, in one of the ways that we are teaching them.
And it's noticeable. Director Jackie Nanauk says Niketchut students often receive citizenship awards when they move over to the big school. Many transition into second grade. In May of the previous year, they spend a few days at June Nelson Elementary, getting used to moving to different classrooms, going to gym, having recess. By third grade, when they take state assessment tests, their academic success is measurable.
They had tested higher in reading, writing, and math, and they had compared former Niketchut students, Northwest Arctic Borough School District students, the June Nelson public school here locally in Kotzebue, and the whole state of Alaska. And in all three categories, reading, writing, and math, the students scored higher.
This year, Niketchut's first students are graduating from high school. Niketchut hopes to expand, moving to a bigger space this summer or next, so they can accept more than the current enrollment of 20 students. Eventually, they'd like to expand the program to go up through sixth grade, or maybe even through high school. But as a nonprofit, the funding is hard to come by. On the North Slope, the public school district is working to integrate culture and academics across all grade levels. Previous efforts focused on inserting culture into academics. Inupiaq Education Department Director Jana Harcharek says that was like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. So, beginning in 2006, the district went through an extensive process with people in all the villages, figuring out what they wanted education to be. Harcharek says collectively, the community came up with a vision for what a successful Inupiaq young adult would look like and came up with an Inupiaq learning framework to bring students to that point. It's divided into four realms, each with its own set of core values. One is environment. There's the historical realm, the individual realm, and community.
In the community realm, we have the elders, ceremonies and celebrations, singing and dancing, storytelling, the arts, parenting, games, and relationships.
The district has come up with grade-level expectations for the Inupiaq framework, the same way the state has grade-level expectations for academic standards. Some of the curriculum materials are already in place. For instance, one fifth-grade unit is called Winter Sources of Drinking Water.
So what the children, what the teachers do with the children is they explore different types of snow to ascertain which kinds of snow produce more water by doing a number of different experiments. They read a story about a family who goes on a trip with their grandfather, and it's based on children in Anaktuvuk Pass. And along the way, they learn different techniques for finding sources of water as well as making water. And so it combines traditional knowledge of water and the making of water and the sources of water with academic science and language arts.
A fourth grade unit called Time and Ptarmigan was so popular with students that a teacher reported using it as a reward for when other work was done.
That's the whole idea, is to be inclusive of their identity and their heritage in our teaching.
Teams of teachers are working through the entire K-12 curriculum for language arts, math, and science, and figuring out how to address both the state academic standards and the Inupiaq learning framework. With only 2 Inupiaq teachers out of about 180, it will take a lot of ongoing training to help teachers be comfortable with both sets of standards. I'm Jessica Cochran.
And this is Kids These Days, and today we're talking about cultural and place-based education. I'm talking with Linda Prince and Paul Ongaguk about what's happening in Alaska. So I would imagine that maybe, Paul, you're familiar with the efforts that Jessica was just talking about in Kotzebue and in Barrow. Is that the case? Yeah.
A little bit. The North Slope was looking at their schools and their test results and the dropout rates and saying, we could keep doing this thing that hasn't been working for a large percentage of our students over the prior 30 years, or we might try to do something else. How about an education that addresses who we are, where we are, the communities that have been here and that are here, and help students to understand what it means to be here and be a contributing member here? I think they're taking first steps. I think one of the risks is that you're going to identify being Alaska Native or Inupiaq as traditional in their model. So they focus on that, whereas to me, what you would want to do is Inupiaq understanding Native corporations, ANILCA, being able to have an informed discussion about 8A contracts, what AFN is. They should know who Evan Hobson is. I think they should know the literature that's been published by Willie Hensley, speeches by Charlie Edwardson. They don't have to pick my selection. Mm-hmm. But
broader than just a particular...
Modern and Inupiaq.
Okay.
And that education is not the formal, the schooling system, it's not a Western education, it's a modern education. And it's something that helps us to become a contributing member of our Alaska Native communities as well as
the community.
As Alaskans.
Yeah, right.
The and as U.S.
Whole.
Citizens.
Right.
That's the experiment that we really haven't seen. On the other end of the spectrum, I'd like to see that every Alaska Native language that is here, in fact, every Native American language that's now here, because half of the Native American languages, more or less, are now relics. They're in museums and archives. They were wiped out under, you know, a 300-year policy of just undermining Native languages and cultures. But of the remaining ones, I'd like to see a K-12 immersion school available for anyone to have that experience of learning that those languages and then teaching English as a second language in those schools.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something we haven't dared to try. But I think it would recast what it means to have an Alaskan education if every Alaskan student had the opportunity to experience a K-12 immersion school in Yupik, Gwich'in,
or
Tlingit.
Yeah.
And I think we would be a better state and have a better state of education if we did that.
This is all the time that we have for today, and I want to thank each of you for being a part of this discussion. It's really been quite wonderful. Thanks so much. Paul Ongaguk is a UAA Education Department professor and an advisor to the Smithsonian Arctic Study Center at the Anchorage Museum. Thanks to you, Paul, for coming back today.
Thank you for having me.
And Linda Prince teaches high school students world history and Alaska studies, and she studied at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. Thank you, Linda, for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I've had a nice time here.
Jessica Cochran is Kids These Days' regular contributor and technical editor. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer, web content editor, and business manager. Thanks to APRN's Dave Waldron for his regular assistance. Lost Lander composed and performed our original theme music. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for spending time with me today, and we'll see you next time.
Kids These Days is an independent production of the Content Producers Guild. The opinions shared on the program are those of the host, guest, and contributors and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KTD producers, partners, or funders. Major funding for Kids These Days comes from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. The program is made in partnership with KSKA-FM in Anchorage and the Alaska Public Radio Network. Find out more about Kids These Days anytime at kidstheseDays.org.